just getting back to that question on where and when was your specialty training?
Well, the next place would have been Lark Hill down in Wiltshire. That was an anti-tank school down there. And then outside of various NCO courses at the artillery schools in the reinforcement bases in Borden, that would be the other sources of, you know, schooling and instruction.
What was specialty training like, or did you notice a difference between that and your other training?
There wasn't that much difference. Probably you got a little bit of the latest that had come out, because in your daily work it was more or less a repetition until some new wrinkle came along or something. But when you went to an artillery school, then you had the latest from the instructors. That it wasn't really that great, but you must remember that we went from a 2-pounder gun through a 6-pounder gun to a 17-pounder towed gun to a 17-pounder self-propelled gun, and there had to be an updating of all your knowledge of the different equipment and everything as you went along.
I see. And how effective was the training? Did it prepare you for action?
No.
No?
No, because there were so many things that you couldn't do in England. It was a small country. It was quite heavily populated. You couldn't go digging up somebody's farmyard to dig a slit trench or a gun position or tear across a field to look for an ideal gun position. You were more or less strapped by what you could do in the territory, unless you got on one of the military reserves, which were few and far between.
Oh, I see.
But as far as being able to exercise adequate self-protection in Britain, as you had to use after you got into action, no, you couldn't do it.
So it didn't, you don't feel, prepare you for
not really, because you were never subjected to what you finally ran into.
Who did you train with? Was there anything like, free French or free Polish or other nationalities that you... Did you train with anything like that?
No, because the extent of that sort of training is what they call a scheme. And it would be a tactical exercise that you might be the defending force, you might be the attacking force. It was either on a divisional basis, a corps basis. At one time we had an army exercise that went from the south coast right clean up to Oxford. And that turned out to be the biggest communication administration shemovel that you ever saw. It turned out to be a proper disaster.
And sorry, who was that with again? That was just within your own unit?
No, that particular exercise was against the British. We were representing the invading force. They were supposed to be the opposition.
And it didn't turn out so well.
No, it was a communications and administrative schmozzle. I think the exercise was called Spartan.
Just out of curiosity, who do you feel performed better during that operation, the Canadians or the British?
I'd say the British, because it was their territory. They were more familiar. They were better, they'd been longer at the game than what we had. Their communications were good. Their transmission or their transportation and their administration was a hell of a lot better. Simply because they'd been at it longer.
Yes. Did you train with anyone who was later to become famous or attained a high position, whether it was a civilian or military later on? Was there anyone notoriety that you trained with?
No, I think one of the best officers commanding we had, though, was a major who is now quite a big stockbroker in Toronto, Major McCarthy. Sadly enough, he was captured in Holland as a result of a ruse.
Really? Could you describe that, or do you know much about it?
Well, yes. He had hadn't been long with the battery because our first major had been killed, and Major McCarthy took over, and it was when we first moved into Holland. He had to take a new officer up to operational position, and coming back, he and his driver were in a jeep, and he observed three or four people out in the middle of a field waving their arms up and down, and he thought these were people in some sort of distress, and he went over. It was about 150, 200 yards off the road to see what they wanted, and the next thing his driver, who had stayed with the jeep, saw was the major with his hands up in the air and being marched off. And he came back and reported to battery headquarters, and they were going to put in a raid to try and get him back, but they were advised against it. And it turned out that these were German soldiers in Canadian helmets, but wearing their camouflage outer clothing, as some of the Canadian snipers in that did.
And do you know much more about that incident?
No. We never even saw him again, as a matter of fact, even after the war.
Were there any training accidents that you either witnessed or were involved with while you were training?
Outside of automobile accidents, no.
Nothing major?
No.
Were there any humorous incidents in training or elsewhere?
Not that I observed. I didn't think anything was humorous at that time.
You found it all pretty serious.
Yes.
Now, once you went overseas, it was 1944 that you went overseas?
No, then? 1940 I went overseas.
Well,
1944
I mean,
and I went to the
Britain,
continent.
Yeah, to the continent is what I'm referring to. Mm. And what mode of transportation, a Liberty ship, is that?
Yeah.
Could you describe a little bit of what travel was like aboard the Liberty ship?
Well, all your guns and vehicles were loaded into the hold. And then they put, I guess, what separates, the divisions in the hold. And you were given a box of compo rations. That was all, immediate food. One box for eight men. And that was supposed to be your sleeping accommodation. Fortunately, we were only on ship for that night. You weren't allowed on deck.
No.
But fortunately, we left Tilbury in the afternoon, and we're over in Arromanches Bay the next day. So there was only really the one night on board ship.
And when you arrived, where were you first stationed?
We weren't stationed, a station, but we were offloaded from the Liberty ship into a landing craft and taken as far close as they could get to the beach and then dumped into the water. We were all waterproof, all our vehicles and everything. And then you went to what they called a de-waterproofing area, where you took all your waterproofing appliances off. And then by the beachmaster, you were given an area where you concentrated until all your unit arrived in one piece. And then from there, the Canadian Army took over and they assigned each outfit to a rendezvous area until the whole, force had been assembled.
This is just a personal question, I think. You know what a duck was? It was one of those tanks that had
dual drive,
Yeah, and they were supposed to be able to float on, drive their way to the beach or something, but they had flotation devices. Did you see
many of those? Well, no, the duck was a self-contained vehicle that had a propeller as well as wheels.
Oh, I see.
You're not thinking of the amphibious tank, which had the flotation devices around the outside.
I remember what I thought was, I guess, an amphibious tank being referred to as a duck. Now, it may have been
incorrectly referred to. No, they're two different
animals.
DD tanks, they call them, dual drive.
Oh, I see.
They had the tracks as well as propeller on the back and this flotation device around the outside. But they didn't prove practical on DD.
Yeah, they weren't used very much then.
No,
after.
Because they didn't pan out.
Yeah. What was your general impression of the first place where you were stationed when you were on arrival?
Well, we landed on Courcelle Beach, and it was a mass of ruins, and busted up equipment and all the rest of it. There was very little wildlife, you might say, as far as people concerned. It was, you know, a few beach troops and that, but they cleared away from the beaches just as soon as they could. We went to a rendezvous overnight in one place, and then the next day, starting about, it'd be about 6 o'clock at night, we moved down to our assigned area, which is down near Carpiquet Airport.
And were equipment and facilities really good there, much better than your previous station? Worse or
Well, the equipment was what we went over with. As far as accommodation went, it was just whatever you made of it. You know, a vacant house, or most of the time you spent in your slip trenches anyway. Usually villages were good places to stay out of, because they were prone to, you know, shelling targets.
Yeah. So I take it most of your stations then would be somewhere between villages and that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course, in Normandy there's a lot of open country. And it was a pretty fluid state, and it was dangerous to be out, you know, and exposing yourself walking about.
So would you be near transportation routes?
Oh, yes, the main roads and everything were heavily used.
Now, your operations when you got over there, which specific post were you assigned to?
Well, I was a battery sergeant major. I was, you're divided into three echelons. There's your F echelon, which is your fighting echelon. That's right in the front line position. There's your A echelon, which is just back of that's administration, and then your B echelon, which was quite a way farther back, that was your base of supply.
I see.
And your battery was divided into three different sections.
And what was your particular outfit that you were with?
We were anti-tank.
Did you choose? No, you chose that outfit. Did you not, or were you?
No, when I first went into artillery, we were an 18-pounder field battery. And then we went from there through reorganization to an anti-tank 2-pounder, and then it progressed up to 6-pounder, and then it went to 17-pounder, and then self-propelled 17. But that was an automatic progression. You had no choice.
See. And so that was the kind of equipment you were dealing with. You progressed up the ladder, so to speak, from 2-pounder up all the way up to the self-propelled unit? The self-propelled unit, what was that? Could you describe a little bit of that?
Well, the self-propelled, it was a tank chassis. They used a Cromwell tank chassis. And they were diesel drive, which was a great advantage over the gasoline engine. And it was a 17-pounder gun mounted on a Cromwell tank. Not Cromwell, Valentine. The Valentine tank. It was one of the latest tanks they brought out. It was a British animal. And very successful.
Yeah. So, You were assigned to your train's specialty as well, then?
Well, no. As a battery sergeant major, you're more or less administrative, unless there are, casualties that need, immediate replacement at your F echelon, maybe as adjutant or second in command or something like that. There wasn't a great surplus of officers, and it was an automatic procedure that you, if there were heavy casualties in F echelon, then you had to go up there and fill in.
And what was your specialty in your particular outfit? Was that the number one gunner?
No, I didn't actually serve on the guns as a battery sergeant major. That was left to you had a troop officer, you had a troop sergeant, and then you had four gun crews. And the troop officer looked after two guns, your troop sergeant looked after the other two guns.
So your specialty within the outfit, would that have been administrative?
No, because on occasion when there was a shortage of officers, I had to go up and take over as troop commander until a replacement officer could be found.
Oh. Uh-huh. And was there any change of rank during this time?
No. I went over as a battery sergeant major, and at the end of the war, I was made acting RSM. That's regimental sergeant major.
Yeah.
But as there was no confirmed promotions or extra pay after VE Day, then there was no more promotions.
And
so my confirmed rank was warrant officer second class.
Oh, I see. And were you given any specific tasks now outside of the filling in that you've already mentioned for fallen officers up in the front? What else? What other tasks?
Well, as the line moved, like your forward line moved, then you had to, come along behind with your second echelon people. You were given a map reference in an area. They may move 3 miles. They may move 25 miles. You had to go into that specific area and pick out a place that was secure and able to get into and all the rest of it for that echelon staff. And then you liaised between there and your F echelon.
Now I'd like to go into a little bit of your action and what happened and that. What unit were you with when you went into battle? Which brigade, division, and?
Well, we're part of the 2nd Division, and most of our time was spent with the 6th Brigade, which was either the South Saskatchewan Regiment, the Camerons, or the Fusilier Mount Royal. We did, on occasion, go in with either of the other two brigades, but we spent most of our time with the 6th Brigade.
And where did you go into action? Where?
Our first taste of action was at Carpiquet Airport, which was just, they were only in, about 8 miles then. And the airport hadn't been taken over then. That was on the 7th of July. Although the D-Day was 31 days before that. D-Day was on June the 6th, and we never actually landed until the 7th, with D plus 31, and we went down to Carpiquet that night. And we were prone to shelling and sniping, that, but the 2nd Division, of which we were part of, was not actually declared in action until 2 days later.
Could you describe, where did you go after that?
It was a progression of short moves then. From Caen, we were on the outskirts of Caen, and then we went down to a place called Fleury-sur-Orne, And that is where the real opposition started. We had heavy losses there, and not only in equipment, but men also. And we were stalemated there for, pretty near 2 weeks.
Still with the 2nd Division 6th Regiment?
6th Brigade, yeah.
Or, pardon me, 6th Brigade. And so there was heavy casualties there, and where did you go after that?
Well, from there we went down through Bretteville-sur-Lez, Claire-Tison, and eventually into Falaise. But the whole progression there from, you might say, Caen down was focused on Falaise. That's where the culminating point was, where they trapped, the German armies between the Canadians, the Poles, and the Americans.
And so that was where most of your action then took place, was in that area?
Yeah.
And
one interesting little sidelight might be is when we're in a place called Ypres. We're in with the South Saskatchewan Regiment then, and I particularly remember this because there was a sniper there from the South Saskatchewan Regiment, and they had their battalion headquarters there, and they were having sniper trouble. Some German was potting at them. And this sniper from the SSR went out, and he got this German guy, sniper. And he brought him back in, where they're going to interrogate him, at the battalion headquarters. Mm-hmm. And when they got finished, this sniper wanted to take this guy out and shoot him. And he got in an argument with the captain there. And his argument was, well, if they capture me, they're going to shoot me, because I'm a sniper. And they finally convinced him, although he's awful mad, that he would be no more useful alive for interrogation than shooting him right there. So the captain from our battery headquarters, myself, had to go back, so we took this German prisoner with us. And the captain was driving the Jeep, and the prisoner was sitting beside him, and I was in the back seat. After we started off, the shelling started, and they had some sunken roads then, and we got down one of these sunken roads, and we were safe for a while there. And it was then I noticed that this German prisoner was looking down in between the two seats where there was a hand grenade laying there in the bottom of the Jeep. And I dunged him on the top of the head with the pistol, and I mentioned, that if you touch that, well, I'm going to let you have it. And it's an experience that not too many people have, where you have that, you might say, opportunity, if you want, that you have to take somebody's life or else to protect your own. And you got to make that choice. If he does that, well, I'm going to do this.
How did you feel about that?
I wasn't hesitant or squeamish, because I realized that it was us if he did what he was planning. Mm. Because a 36 grenade goes off in a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
And it would mean a whole bunch of us. But he was prepared to do that. We found out that he was an SS NCO. He had torn all his insignia off, including they all wore silver braid around the collar on their uniforms. But he had taken that all off.
Yeah, you mentioned, you mentioned some battle that you did do with some troops, which you said were not all that good except for, this was the opposition, were not very good except for some SS troops.
That was up in Holland, on the outskirts of the Scheldt. We were in, Walcheren Peninsula went out, and we stayed as buffer troops so that they wouldn't get any flank attack. And they had, it was in canal country, and on one side of the canal was the German infantry, and we were on the other side. And it turned out that these were mostly elderly people, and one who had stomach troubles, because they had their own cows. And they had to have their milk daily. There were a lot of young soldiers in there, too. They were brought back there, maybe from you know, the Russian front or elsewhere. But they had all SS NCOs who kept these guys toeing the line, and they had a lot of snipers with them too. And our program was is to mortar the behind these guys to drive them up to the canal where we could get at them. And the SS had the idea that they would mortar in front of them and chase them back again. So we chased them back and forth there for hours. And you, even at night, they carried on the same thing. But and you could hear them because their equipment that they had tied on their belts, you know, rattled and clanged. But eventually, the mortaring, I guess, got too much for the German NCOs. And these guys all came across the canal. And, oh, it turned out there was about, just about 70 of them. But they were, you know, second-rate troops, but they were glad to give up because of their, you know, condition. And if it hadn't been for the SS NCOs that they had, they'd probably have given up a lot sooner.
You didn't stay with your the particular units, like the 2nd Division, 6th Brigade. Did you stay with them all the time?
No.
You didn't. Which ones did you switch to?
Well, we went down with either the 4th or the 5th. Then, as we got into Holland, there was a manpower shortage. Like, the recruits weren't coming in from, or replacements from Canada. And we spent the winter of, 44, 45, as infantry, up on the, it would be the Dutch-German border. And we hadn't had too much experience as infantry, so it was quite a switch for us anyway. Well, but it was up on the, as I say, the Dutch-German border, and it's where all the airborne had landed. It was almost like prairie country, rolling, you know, land. And there was all these gliders and crashed planes out there that were all still intact with their contents, like jeeps and small artillery pieces, machine guns, mines, everything. Radios.
Why were these still sitting there? I mean,
because
equipment.
They were under fire from both sides. Like if the Germans went out, we'd fire at them. If we went out,
No man's land.
Yeah, it turned out to be no man's land. And what they did, like somebody had the idea of, gee whiz, there's a nice jeep in there. Maybe I'll sneak out tonight and get it. And after a few of those, they discovered that when the Germans were out there, they booby-trapped all these things.
Oh.
So after a few guys had been killed, then they washed it out because the Canadians used to go out and they would booby-trap what wasn't already booby-trapped in case the Germans tried the same thing. Yeah. So outside of, you know, getting the odd parachute and stuff like that, it wasn't
worth
it.
That stuff.
No.
And so, after that, where did you go to?
Well, we, from Nijmegen and Germany, we went up then to Groningen, which is up in north-central Holland. Mm-hmm. And they finally pushed through to the North Sea there. But there again, that was a hairy, bloody scheme too, because the good troops had been pushed ahead. Like they were good German troops. And they finally got backed up into northern Holland there. Mm-hmm. And they put up, you know, a good fight. And from there, after we got out of Groningen, we went over, it was getting towards the end of the war, we ended up in Wilhelmshaven. Mm. Over on the... that was right in Germany itself, near Bremen.
And was there anything after that, or?
Well, we were in Oldenburg, which was just north of that, still in Germany, on VE Day. Mm-hmm. We were in Oldenburg on VE Day.
I'd like to just back you up for a moment and there was a place where you said there was heavy casualties. Now, I think that was Falaise, wasn't it?
At Falaise, yeah, before we went into there.
Well, you weren't in there when there was the heavy casualties? Or?
Oh, yes, but that's like on the move up to there, as you got closer to Falaise, then the Germans who were trying to get out of the trap put on more pressure to the outside. And our idea was to compress the pocket they had there and contain them. And the more that happened, the more resistance you ran into. And they were trying to get out, and the Allies were trying to hold them in. And it could be that we were too thinly spread, or they were more familiar with the terrain there, and we had, you know, more than our share of casualties there, in equipment and men.
Do you remember any numbers, any figures, or?
No, not. I couldn't put a figure on it.
Not exact, no. But I mean roughly.
I would say we had out of one troop. I guess we had about 15 casualties. That'd be four guns.
I'm just curious about who was your directly ahead of you in command.
Well,
superior.
My superior would be the captain. We had two captains. Mm-hmm. One was administrative, and the other one was like the fighting captain. And my immediate superior was a fighting captain.
Do you remember any names?
Oh, yes. The major we landed with was... he was killed at First Rorn. No, just what was his name? Rogers. Major Rogers. He was killed there. Funnily enough, the position that he was in, they had seen an opportunity to expand, and he and four other battery or commanders, they would be majors from the infantry and engineers and that, took off in a four jeep convoy. They came down this road, and there was a right hand turn to go down to St. Andre-sur-Orne. And they were in maybe 20 feet apart, but unbeknownst to them, the Germans had sneaked in an 88 gun over about 1,000 yards away, covering this intersection here. And that guy was such a good gunner that he picked off these jeeps 1, 2, 3, 4, killed drivers and majors and every one of them. And then that's when we got next day this major I was talking about that was taken prisoner in Holland that he took over. But he had been with the 3rd Division. He came in on the invasion, and he was more experienced and, I'd say, a more efficient man.
Were you ever injured while you were, you were over, fighting in Europe?
No.
No?
No.
Were there ever any close calls, or...?
Oh, yes. I had lots of close calls, but they never, actually made bodily contact, fortunately.
I guess, do you remember a lot of friends in that finished off the war from your unit with you?
Not a lot. I mean, some. I've only just recently renewed contact with some of the people that were in our battery through an ad I saw in the Legion magazine. And it's nice to renew all, acquaintances and experiences and that. As a matter of fact, there's one of them I started corresponding with who comes from Winnipeg, and he's coming out here this summer. I don't know, they're spread all over Canada. Originally, we were British Columbia battery, but then as the war progressed, I guess we ended up, you might say, 60% Ontario.
Yeah, I guess with replacements and that, yeah. A lot of turnover, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think I'm finished. Thank you very much.
Thank you.